You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I've been here many times in many meetings, and I have never in any of those meetings seen the unanimity without complaint of a sense of direction and commitment to the concept of inclusivity and of addressing the unaddressed issues of the last 8 years or more.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry begins his tour of the Middle East as President Barack Obama prepares to address the nation later tonight. Here to discuss what's on the agenda are the former British Ambassador John Everard and Jim Hoare of SOAS in London. Also ahead.
I care far more about my country than I do about my party. I care hugely about this extraordinary country, this United Kingdom that we've built together.
Another hard day's campaigning slash grovelling by David Cameron and other British party leaders ahead of that looming independence referendum in Scotland. We'll have that, plus the latest from our man in Italy, a review of Spanish television and an interview with a man Booker Prize nominee. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But ahead of all that, Barney Burnham has the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The US Secretary of State John Kerry says he's greatly encouraged by the formation of a new government in Iraq, which he described as a major milestone. He was speaking in Baghdad at the start of a tour of the Middle East to build military, political and financial support to defeat Islamic State militants controlling parts of Iraq and Syria. He held talks with Iraq's new Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, who says his country is ready to play its full part in the fight against Islamic State.
There are still people from all over the world. They have funds coming from across the region. We are fighting these people. These people are slaughtering our communities, minorities, women, children. They are even selling women. They are a challenge to the whole region, to the international community. They are coming to Iraq from across the border, from neighboring Syria. Of course, our role is to defend our country.
Last week, nine countries, most of them in Europe, were named as the core group of a coalition President Obama says will degrade and eventually destroy Islamic State. Later tonight, the president will outline the next phase of his plan in a national TV broadcast. Former US Vice President Dick Cheney has told a conservative think tank in Washington that Obama should strike targets inside Syria or risk the loss of American credibility.
The situation is dire, and defeating these terrorists will require immediate, sustained, simultaneous action across multiple fronts. Phasing in our actions will not suffice. Such a strategy will only prolong the conflict and increase the casualties. ISIS does not recognize a border between Syria and Iraq, so neither should we. We should immediately hit them in their sanctuary, staging areas, command centers, and lines of communication, wherever we find them.
Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says Russia has removed the bulk of its forces from his country, raising hopes for a peace drive now underway after 5 months of conflict in which more than 3,000 people have been killed. A ceasefire is currently still holding across most of eastern Ukraine. Amnesty International has accused Russia of direct involvement in the conflict, publishing a report which it says documents evidence of war crimes by both sides. The group said Moscow could also be liable for human rights abuses. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has skipped his weekly question and answer session in Parliament to travel to Scotland to campaign against Scottish independence. Next week, voters in Scotland will decide whether or not to break away from the United Kingdom. Mr. Cameron's been pressed into action after polls suggested a shift towards a yes vote.
I care far more about my country than I do about my party. I care hugely about this extraordinary country, this United Kingdom that we've built together. And that's what I want to talk about today. Because I would be heartbroken if this family of nations that we've put together and that we've done such amazing things together, if this family of nations was torn apart.
Thousands of passengers at Munich Airport have been affected by an 8-hour strike by pilots at Lufthansa, which ended an hour ago. It's their third walkout in 2 weeks. 140 flights have been affected. The pilots want to increase pressure on Lufthansa in negotiations over an early retirement scheme. They held a strike at its budget carrier Germanwings at the end of August, followed by a walkout in Frankfurt last week. The board of Spain's Santander Bank has appointed Ana Botín, head of its British business, as its new chairwoman. She succeeds her father Emilio Botín, who has died of a heart attack. He transformed Santander from a small domestic lender into the Eurozone's biggest bank, and he changed the face of Spanish banking with the purchase of the British lender Abinational for more than £9 billion in 2004. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Coming up for 18.07 here in London, that'll be 13.07 in New York. Joining me now for this first half of tonight's episode of Midori House with their take on the news. Here in the studio I have John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, and the author of the North Korea memoir Only Beautiful, Please, and Jim Hoare, former British Shah d'affaires in North Korea, now of the Centre of Korean Studies at SOAS here in London. We won't be starting with Korea, though we will get there. We will start with the Middle East, and a little less than a week since President Barack Obama made the embarrassing but self-evident statement that the US didn't have a strategy yet for dealing with the Islamic State in Syria, this will, we are told, shortly be rectified. Obama is due to address the American people later tonight. Secretary of State John Kerry is on a whistle-stop tour of the Middle East, either or both shoring up support or resisting the urge to wonder out loud why the region's countries can't sort their own problems out for a change. Jim, I'll start with you. Obama has to say something pretty dramatic, doesn't he?
I think he set the scene last night when he said to Congress that I can go to war without you if necessary. He didn't use the word war, but he said I can go in, send the military in without you. So I think, yes, he is preparing people for something dramatic. And quite clearly, the United States is going to go back into the Middle East, having said it wouldn't.
They are likely, I think, still to sort of stick to this boots-on-the-ground thing as something they don't want to do. But Obama needs to find something in between bombing the Islamic State, which they're already doing, and sending troops, which he doesn't want to do. So, John, there are suggestions that he's going to announce strikes within Syria. That does appear to be the next logical step, doesn't it?
Yes, it does appear to be the next logical step. And I think also, before very long, he will move to much heavier armament of both the Iraqi armed forces and, critically, the Peshmerga, who for quite a while have been the only viable anti-IS force in the region. Remember, not long ago, the US swore it would never arm the Peshmerga. That is another U-turn, and of course is a significant step towards a separate Kurdish state.
Both you gentlemen had a career as professional diplomats, as professional persuaders, so I'll put this to you each in turn, starting with you, Jim. If you are the President of the United States at this point in the democratic experiment, how do you go about persuading the American people that, to some extent, they need to go back to war, not only in Iraq, but in a whole other Middle Eastern country as well?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure I really know the answer. I think the approach, it seems to be that, look, we're doing our best to sort this out with creating a coalition of the willing, another coalition of the willing in the Middle East, and that requires us to provide the leadership. We don't want to do the actual ground business, the troops on the ground ourselves, but we do need to work hard at this, and I need to feel that I have the American people behind me. So I'm appealing to you to support the policies that we're following. I've sent Mr. Kerry to the Middle East to go around talking to the various people that we need to get on side. And then I think, you know, we'll say we're going, because ultimately the president can go to war without actually going to Congress.
John, following that point up, do you sense a kind of good cop, bad cop routine going on with the American administration? Because we've had Vice President Biden talking about following ISIS to the gates of hell, John Kerry talking today about a spread of evil, and you would have thought that Americans would be very, very careful with slogans ending with the phrase of evil at this point. This, of course, is not the sort of language you can imagine Barack Obama ever using about anything. It's just not him. Do you think this is a deliberate strategy?
I don't know about a deliberate communication strategy. It may well be. It may be that President Obama has asked his colleagues to use rather firmer words, shall we say, than he, as president, is allowed to use by, you know, by the dignity of his office. One important point, I think, in all this is that you just said, how does he persuade the American people? The American people don't seem to need persuading. The opinion polls are out.
True enough.
65% in favor of strikes, and that's double the percentage of a year ago, when, of course, Obama had to back down from strikes on Syria. I detect overall a new mood, both in Washington and across America. I think there's a new willingness to engage America's military muscle in pursuit of its strategic objectives, which, if that's true, of course, has implications well beyond the Middle East. And I hope that Vladimir Putin is watching carefully.
You talk about a new mood. It struck me as another interesting question to put to a couple of professional diplomats that... It sounds wrong to talk about the achievements of the Islamic State, but something they have accomplished, albeit obviously inadvertently, is they have now managed to organize all on one side: the United States, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Hezbollah, and Kurdistan all now have a huge shared interest in the Middle East. If we're going to try to be insanely optimistic about this, might there be the beginnings of a new series of more productive relationships in the Middle East? Jim, I'll ask you first.
I don't know. I have grave doubts that would be the outcome. I mean, the trouble is, if America gets more and more involved in the Middle East, it won't be very long before you have Middle Eastern countries or Middle Eastern groups saying, it was the Americans who caused this in the first instance, well, and so we're back to that sort of...
The Arab League, hilariously, who spent the previous decade bitching about America's involvement in Iraq, are now blaming America's non-intervention in Syria for the existence of the Islamic State. America really can't win, so there's that.
The other thing I heard last night was a thing about Saudi Arabia saying... People are saying it's partly our fault, but no, it's not our fault. It's somebody else's fault, not saying whose fault, and we are also in danger, so... you know, I think this may hold for a bit, but I'm not sure it can hold for very long without recrimination.
John, are we going to see joint press conferences helmed by John Kerry and Hassan Nasrallah?
I think that's unlikely. And I'm not sure I'd go as far as saying more constructive relationships. I think we might hope for less destructive relationships. I think already we're seeing signs of that. The Iranian torrent of propaganda against the United States has been remarkably quiet over the last few weeks, as Iran realizes that quite a lot of what America is doing is actually in Iran's interest. If we don't have a love-in, and I think that might be a bit much to hope for, at least we might get a kind of agreement to shout at each other and perhaps partly to work together cooperatively in some areas. Let's see.
Well, on the subject, moving seamlessly along of working cooperatively together, we'll look a little closer to where we are currently sitting. Since a referendum on Scottish independence was formally announced last December, it has barely impacted on political life south of the border. This has partly been due to a proper recognition that it's a matter for Scotland, partly because of the reality that there's a limit to the persuasive powers of posh English politicians north of the border, and partly because of a complacent assumption that it would be comfortably defeated. After a couple of close polls in the last week, however, panic stations have been declared. John, why did nobody see this coming?
Because all the indications were quite clearly that it wasn't. And the sudden swing in the polls has not only thrown the politicians, it's also, if you look at some of the nerdier polling blogs, thrown the professional statisticians. This shouldn't have happened. One of the curious things about the recent results is that the number of undecided has gone down just a bit, but not very much. What has happened is that people who a week ago were telling pollsters that they would vote no have changed their minds and switched into the yes camp. Now, that is very unusual and very significant and probably just a little bit scary.
Jim, what do you think is driving that sudden surge to yes? Because as that surge has existed, there has been a ramping up of sort of warnings, I guess, of the economic, especially the economic consequences of it. And that just seems to be galvanising people.
Well, I suspect that is right, that it is the scare tactics, if you like, if you put it in its most extreme form, coming out of Westminster, have made many Scots feel that, no, we can do it. We're a large group of people. We're over 5 million. We have a long history of economic development, and we can do these things. And we're not going to be told by the posh boys from the south, which is how they would regard
the
it.
The three of whom, Cameron, Miliband and Clegg, are in Scotland at the moment.
Yes, but they're in Scotland at the moment. Where were they between December and now? I think John is absolutely right. It was complacency.
Yeah, on that subject, though, and it's obviously far too late to change this, I think there's been a complacency in the way the poll has been constructed, because it strikes me as bizarre, certainly as an outsider to this country, that we've ended up in a situation where if it's a close vote for yes, it could very well have been that it was swung by foreign citizens of EU countries resident in Scotland, perhaps only temporarily resident, who are entitled to vote in this referendum, whereas many hundreds of thousands of actual Scots who live in the rest of Britain or abroad are not entitled to a vote. Wouldn't that be slightly ridiculous, John? I'll ask you first.
Yes. In the realities of modern electorates, it's very difficult to get neat electoral boundaries, and there's going to be rough justice whichever way the vote goes. If the decision either way is very, very narrow, then I think we can expect the other side to cry foul and to make just the kind of points that you've made, that the vote wasn't representative in some way, and they would have a certain amount of moral force on their side.
Jim, looking at the political ramifications on this side of the border, David Cameron, Prime Minister of the country, it would strike me that a fairly minimal requirement for being Prime Minister of a country, that the country is more or less the same size it was when you arrived in the job. Can he survive a yes vote?
He's saying he can, and I suspect that he's right, that, you know, there's much more tradition of countries breaking up than we often realise.
True enough.
Places that look as though they were settled, split and divide. This has been something that's been developing, not just in the last couple of years. It's been developing for years and years and years, this move towards Scottish independence, Scotland running its own show. I think, of course, the 1980s and Mrs. Thatcher convinced many in Scotland that they were getting a rough deal from London and that they would need to go their own way. And whatever happens on the day of the referendum, it looks as though Scotland is going to get a lot more powers anyway. So it's going to be a different country that we have the end of September from what we started with at the beginning of September, whatever the outcome of this particular vote.
I agree entirely with all of that. Two other points. Firstly, you asked, is he going to survive a yes vote? Of course he is. If there's a yes vote, that takes all the Scottish votes out of the next general election, which very strongly increases the chances of the Tory party being returned to power and Cameron keeping his job. The other point is that this is not just about Scotland, that Northern Ireland and Wales are watching very carefully what extra powers are given to the Scottish Parliament.
Especially Northern Ireland. We will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, as well as John Everard and Jim Hall. When we return, we'll be looking at China in Africa and the internet in North Korea.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up for 1820 in London. Still with me are John Everard and Jim Hoare. Now, it was reported earlier this week that China was dispatching an infantry battalion to troubled South Sudan as part of the UN peacekeeping mission there. This turned out to be a misunderstanding, but clarifying that misunderstanding yielded the fact that a 700-strong contingent of the People's Liberation Army will be arriving later this year, adding to the 1,800 Chinese soldiers already serving with UN missions elsewhere in Africa. Jim, up until the last few years, China's been content to sort of buy Africa, really, by the yard and build infrastructure, most obviously and symbolically, the actual African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. Is this kind of a recognition, I guess, of the historical pattern that military influence tends to follow commercial interest?
Well, it is UN influence, isn't it?
True enough.
They're not going in on their own to defend some Chinese possession. So I think it is rather different from that historical tradition.
But the fact that there are Chinese interests there will not have passed them by.
Well, I'm sure that's true. I think the Chinese interests are now so widespread throughout countries that provide raw materials that you can see that anywhere there was a problem that the Chinese might go in and people would give it this sort of construction, that this is, you know, China looking after its own interests, unlike every other country in the world, which of course is not the case. I think in one sense this is the way you would expect a major power, a member of the P5, to start behaving. The curious thing was that for a long, long, long time, the Chinese, though they joined the UN back in the early 1970s, didn't do any of this sort of thing. They kept well back from it. Now they are taking on, they would say, their international responsibilities, and the world should welcome it.
John, is that the case? Is this China just deciding if it's going to be a grown-up country, it should do grown-up stuff like this? Are they acting entirely selflessly?
Countries don't act entirely selflessly. That's just not the way things work, sadly. There may well be let's prove that we are a growing power in this. But I think there is a commercial background. China is very concerned about what's happening in South Sudan. It's heavily invested in the oil industry there. The country provides 5% of China's oil, and cutting off the taps would hurt China. So yes, you know, China is looking after its own interests. I agree there with Jim. That's not a bad thing. I mean, other countries, in attempts to preserve their commercial interests, have actually taken very constructive actions. And we see China doing the same thing. It's not just sending these 700 troops, but it's also working very hard behind the scenes to bring the warring parties together, trying to achieve a peaceful solution to the South Sudanese conflict. I say all part of the rainbow.
Okay, well, while we still have some time before the bottom of the hour, we are going to move along to North Korea, previous bailiwick of both of you. The famously paranoid state has apparently announced that foreign embassies and NGOs in the country can no longer use Wi-Fi to access the internet. John, briefly, why?
Because it turns out that the Wi-Fi from a lot of embassies is, quote, leaking, unquote. It's not encrypted, and it can be picked up by college students walking around outside the embassies. One particular Middle Eastern embassy is apparently notorious for this, and also by families who choose to move in to the flats around the embassy quarter. And this, of course, has worried the authorities. As a fascinating insight into the new North Korea, it seems that the way the authorities tumbled to what is going on was when they arrested an estate agent. Of course, estate agents...
Say that like it's a bad thing.
Well, estate agents are banned in North Korea. Perhaps estate agents should be banned in other countries too, but anyway, they arrested him. And he was charging high prices for these flats. People were prepared to sell apartments in prestigious areas elsewhere in Pyongyang to move in and to be able to use the embassy's internet.
Have they not thought of asking the NGOs and embassies to do that thing of, like, you know, naming their Wi-Fi networks funny, amusing names, or off-putting amusing names in this case? They could have said sort of, like, you know, Secret Service Detective Van or something.
Yes, they asked the embassies to do that a little while ago. Most embassies simply sniffed and ignored the instruction. And it's not clear yet whether embassies are going to take this current instruction any more seriously. We'll see.
Jim, are the North Korean... I mean, this sounds like a slightly redundant question, but I'm sure you get a vastly different view of it when you actually live there, as you both have. Are the authorities genuinely this paranoid, or is this the kind of thing where you get lower level bureaucrats thinking that this is the sort of thing I must get excited about because this is the sort of thing the higher ups would want me to do?
I should think it's probably both. I think they are nervous of information flowing in from outside. I mean, all the signs are that this is a real concern for them, whether it's newspapers or books or what have you. And the internet is, of course, far more of a threat in the sense that it lays the whole world open to people who have access to it. They've always been a bit nervous about international communications. They've conceded in the past that people could have diplomatic radio. By the time I went there in 2001, nobody was using diplomatic radio any longer in North Korea. And the new method was the internet and communications that way. And that took a huge battle. It took us 12 months to actually get them to agree to something they signed up to when we established diplomatic relations, that we could operate our own secure internet connections. But I suspect a lot of embassies are pretty careless about what they do and what is available. And this is the result. I mean, it's not just the North Koreans who are worried about the possible effects of embassies having unrestricted access to the outside world. In most countries, you are supposed to register your communication system with the authorities. And in one of the things I read, the North Koreans have actually said, yes, you've got to encrypt it and you've got to register it and you've got to protect it. I'm not sure they're quite... they're not banning the use of such communications, they're banning the sort of side use of it by people, as John described.
John, what is the general level of internet usage in North Korea for want of a less pejorative expression, ordinary North Koreans?
Very close to zero. The internet does not exist in North Korea outside embassies, as we've just been discussing, and the compounds of the senior leadership. There is an intranet which works only within North Korea and therefore conveys only North Korean information. But that, of course, is a very different beast. Ordinary North Koreans not only have no access to the internet, the great majority of them don't know it exists.
There's some institutions in North Korea, the Foreign Trade Ministry, the Foreign Ministry, the... societies for cultural relations with foreign countries that do have limited access via the intranet to the outside world. But you never get an individual address. You get a sort of commune address and you send your email to them. And if you're lucky, that's eventually passed to the person concerned and a reply would come back. But that's pretty rare.
Senior North Korean diplomats told me that if they wanted information from the internet in Pyongyang, they were not allowed to access it directly. There was one internet guardian in their ministry, and they would go to him with a written request for the information. He would go away, look it up, give a written response to that request, but you never actually sat in front of a computer screen yourself. That was much too dangerous.
Extraordinary. But while we are up this way, we should also look at the impending trial of Matthew Todd Miller, the American citizen due before the beak in Pyongyang on Sunday, I think, for apparently tearing up his visa and seeking asylum in the country. John, I'll ask you first, as far as it's possible to discern, what is going on here?
It's very difficult to discern. Why would anybody rip up their visa on arrival in North Korea and seek asylum in North Korea of all countries?
It seems an unlikely way to behave.
Unlikely is a diplomatic word, Andrew, yes.
I'm learning, John, I'm learning.
Okay. What is going on? I think the North Koreans were simply bemused by this person, his actions, didn't know what to do, thought about it for a while, decided there might be some propaganda value in this, and have decided to charge him with something or other. They haven't yet said with what, and put him on trial, which is what they've done with other Americans. It's interesting that his family are refusing comment, and the US State Department has been notably silent on the whole case. I think they're probably a bit confused as well.
Jim, John mentioned the other Americans. There are two other US citizens, Jeffrey Fowle and Kenneth Bay, also being held in North Korea. Are they prisoners or hostages?
Well, Bay has been sentenced, so he is a prisoner by anybody's definition. The other gentleman, the one who left his Bible in a hotel or in a restaurant, has not yet been formally charged. I think they have probably, under North Korean law, committed offences. So in that sense, they are prisoners. I think they're also perhaps seen as a possible bargaining power with the United States.
But just finally and very briefly, once each, what kind of thing would North Korea want in return for three US citizens?
Recognition.
A senior visit.
Yeah.
They're after pulling preferably a former president into Pyongyang so they can put in front of television cameras, as they did with Jimmy Carter, as they did with Bill Clinton.
Yep, Shaquille O'Neal presumably not quite going to crack it. John Everard and Jim Hoare, we will have to leave it there. Thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be hearing from Joshua Ferris, who's just been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. We'll have the latest from our man in Italy, and we'll be reviewing What's on the Box in Spain. But before we get started on all that, Barney Burnham has the headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. US Secretary of State John Kerry says he's greatly encouraged by the formation of a new government in Iraq. He was speaking in Baghdad at the start of a tour of the Middle East to build military, political and financial support to defeat Islamic State militants. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says Russia has removed the bulk of its forces from his country, raising hopes for a peace drive now underway after 5 months of conflict in which more than 3,000 people have been killed. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has skipped his weekly question and answer session in Parliament to travel to Scotland to campaign against Scottish independence. He's been pressed into action after polls suggested a shift towards a yes vote in next week's referendum. Thousands of passengers at Munich Airport have been affected by an 8-hour strike by pilots at Lufthansa, which ended an hour and a half ago. It's their third walkout in 2 weeks. 140 flights were affected. The board of Spain's Santander Bank has appointed Ana Botín, head of its British business, as its new chairwoman. She succeeds her father, Emilio Botín, who has died of a heart attack. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. Welcome back to Midori House, live here from Studio One at Midori House. It's now 21:32 in Moscow. That's 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we have spun the globe and stuck the dart in Italy, from where I'm joined by Ivan Cavallo. Ivan, welcome to the show. I wanted to start with Italy's now still newish Prime Minister. He's not getting the reviews he was.
No, good evening, Andrew. He's Matteo Renzi is he's popular still, but the honeymoon is over and the summer holidays are over, and his critics are sharpening the knives and they're waiting for results. And Matteo Renzi, on the reform front, is still at this point a lot of talk and not a lot of results, you could say.
Was there anything he could be expected to do this quickly, though? Because Italy's problems are not new ones and they're not small ones.
Yeah, this is true. They are deep-seated and they are quite difficult to tackle. So to be fair, he does have still a lot of breathing room. He is a bit ambitious. Having met him in the past when he was mayor of Florence, he would have these sweeping plans to do 100 things to change Florence. He's gone from his 100 days blitz to change Italy to now 1,000 days of reform. So I think he's become a bit more realistic about how long it's going to take to change the culture, not just in the government and Rome, but also getting society to go along with these reforms.
I mean, Italy has recently been in the news because, you know, Italy has managed to leverage the foreign minister Federica Mogherini into the top EU foreign policy job. Has that been seen as a triumph for Renzi, or is in Italy, as in most places, foreign affairs not really a vote winner?
Yeah, I think that spending that kind of political capital on this post, while it does give Italy the clout in Brussels, one has to wonder if he could have done something differently. He did win the EU election. He didn't win. Yet he still hasn't taken his party to a national election. But in the EU elections, he did a lot better than the traditional parties. And he was in a position to really leverage that against the austerity in Germany and Angela Merkel and try to put together a front to say, look, let's ease off a bit on the austerity and we need to grow it because, like other places, Italy is not going to grow this year. And unemployment is stuck very high. And GDP is basically at the level it was in 2000. So there is a mountain to climb still.
Does Renzi have a central theme? Does he have one big idea, or is he trying to do a whole bunch of stuff and arguably too much of it?
I think the criticism you could lay at his doorstep is that while he is youthful and very enthusiastic and ambitious, he does tend to get a bit lose sight of one task and onto other things and likes to micromanage. And I think at this point, it's become a bit of a problem in terms of, you know, critics are saying he needs to focus on economic reforms first and foremost, get something concrete passed, not just in, you know, the parliament where it's being discussed, but through parliament and passed to help, for example, lower payroll taxes, cut some spending, these sorts of things. And so I think, you know, that's a criticism. You can definitely say that he likes to micromanage it and he needs to delegate more.
Well, one fairly visible problem he is confronted with, though it's not necessarily one of his making, is illegal immigrants arriving in Italy. This is obviously because of Italy's proximity to North Africa. It's been a record year this year. What is driving this influx and how is Italy coping?
Yeah, this is a long-standing problem, and obviously it's been exacerbated by the war in Syria. You have people going over land into Libya, now Libya being, of course, very unstable. People are moving through Libya, and the boat people who are trying to migrate over, it's a massive problem. There are almost 2,000 deaths this year. The ministry was in Brussels recently hoping for some results. In Brussels, the Home Affairs Commissioner stated that Frontex, the EU border agency, which is based in Warsaw, and people are wondering if that's a good idea or not, I think, in Italy, they were offering now some talk that sounds like Brussels is going to help in November, which, if one knows the crossings in the Mediterranean, they happen in the warmer months that where they tend to. So this sort of a call by Brussels to ask member states to give some more money and troops and ships is still voluntary. So I don't know how much of it's going to really help. You know, Italy's spending 10 million euros a month. They have landing ships, patrol ships, the Coast Guard, the Carabinieri. They have a lot of resources, and they're going into international waters a lot of times for search and rescue, because the migrants are often given by traffickers sat phones to call to say, we are here. And it's a rescue mission, whereas Frontex, the border agency, might not at this point want to go beyond the EU border. So this is a problem that Italy's trying to deal with. Whether or not Renzi's new foreign minister in Brussels can push on that issue, we'll have to see.
You mentioned there the ghastly death toll that has been racked up this year, at least 2,000 people drowned at sea. How is Italy's media and public responding to this? Illegal immigration tends to arouse mixed feelings. People are, on the one hand, I think, are sympathetic, but also I think people would be more sympathetic if they were going somewhere else.
Yeah, indeed. I have to say, having reported from Lampedusa and seeing the work the Italians day in and day out rescuing these people, going to international waters, almost close to the Libyan coast, in fact. You know, they've done a remarkable job. There is a bit of, at this point, I think because of the economic crisis in Italy, let's say that people are concerned about their jobs, and actually immigrants do pass through Italy and go into the richer nations too. So there's some antagonism in the other EU countries that, you know, the Italians are letting them through, but then the Italians are the ones that are right now dealing with the problem. And you know, this is a classic thing where in Europe there hasn't been a united solution, and Italy's hoping for some results. We'll have to see if they can orchestrate something at a wider level, Mediterranean level, to tackle this problem.
And finally, Ivan, it would be remiss of us not to mention the World Gelato Finals, which were held this past weekend in Rimini. Who were the winners?
Well, surprisingly, a father and son from Sydney won the contest.
That makes me proud.
I think it's quite interesting, actually. It was put on. This event was put on by Carpigiani, which is a company that makes these machines, and they're actually hoping for a boom overseas, and they brought contestants from as far away as Vancouver and Sydney and Dubai. Often they were people who were Italians who had gone overseas to open gelaterias. But as you've seen with the winners, there are also people out there around the world who are capable of making high-quality gelato. And Italy, this Italian company, and others are looking to see that there is a market out there. They expect it to be upwards of $10 billion a year. And so this is a way to sort of promote this healthy, obviously, dessert, because there's more than half the fat content that you find in the less healthy ice cream out there.
But I think what we've learnt there, Ivan, is that Australians are just great. Ivan Cavallo, thank you very much. Up next on Midori House, we'll be hearing from one of the two Americans on the shortlist for the Man Booker Prize. Stay tuned to find out more on Midori House on Monocle 24.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1841 in London. The Man Booker Prize shortlist is out. It's the first year that the prize has been open to all authors writing in English. Joshua Ferris is one of two Americans who's made it onto this year's shortlist of six, with a book concerning dentistry, soul searching, and the worldwide ebb. Worldwide ebb? Worldwide web. It's got a W in front of it and everything. The book is called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. Earlier today, Joshua spoke to Monocle's Thomas Lewis from New York. He began by telling Tom what it meant to be an American in the running for the Booker Prize.
Perhaps in the way that all foreign things work, so to speak, it has a touch of even greater prestigiousness because we're excluded from ever attaining it, or have been up until last year. So it's not only a prestigious award, but also a kind of exotic one. We certainly take it, those of us who are readers and writers over here, we take it to be an extremely big deal. So to be shortlisted is a particular honor in for a number of reasons. When I first heard that it was going to be open to Americans, I thought, I don't know if that's really necessary. I mean, we learn about so much writing that we wouldn't otherwise by virtue of it being, confined to certain territories. And then I was longlisted and I thought, well, now I get it. Of course, this is the right decision. So it's, it just kind of, it gives us another opportunity, I think, to expand our readership.
Well, the book that has given you that opportunity is To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. Now, your novel tells the story of Paul O'Rourke, who's a New York dentist, who lives life but doesn't quite know how to live it at its fullest, if that's a fair summary. Give us a sense of the character you've created in Paul.
Well, he's a mess, really. I mean, he doesn't know how to live. He's a dentist who's looking every day into the mouths of people who have neglected them. He sees rot and decay and death everywhere about him. And he's just, he's left empty. And the thing that leaves him coldest is religion and technology. These two things together. And then one day he finds that his identity has been stolen online, and he's got to reconfigure a whole lot of things. He's got to figure out why somebody would do such a thing, and then he's got to adapt. And what he finds out is that he may or may not belong to an ancient religion that has been oppressed for years and years, and he's got to figure out if, in fact, he belongs to this group, and if it, or rather what it might mean to him.
This is set in New York City, which is often described as somewhere that's at once bustling, but actually can be a fairly lonely place too. Is he embarking on this journey totally alone?
Well, he has some colleagues at the dental office. He has his hygienist who breaks his balls. And then he's got his office manager who he's just broken up with. And they keep him company throughout the day. But yeah, mainly it's a very solitary, lonely, existential path that he's on. He's trying to find meaning, and everywhere he looks, there's the lack thereof. It is the suggestion by the person that steals his identity that he might belong to something greater than himself that gets him thinking in different ways. And I think it is a kind of antidote to his narrow focus in life, is a possibility that something broader and more meaningful might be brought into his daily existence that intrigues him, even in spite of himself, because he's a man that loathes religions, especially organized religions. So he has to sort of peek with one eye closed at the possibility that he belongs to something by birthright, by blood.
And it's the internet that allows him to take this peek, or not allows him, maybe forces him to take a peek at this possible other life lived by him, unawares to him. What kind of character does the internet play? Does that compound his loneliness, or is it a door opening to a new chapter in his life in the book?
He compares it at the beginning of the book. He compares the internet to wealth, and he says it's just like when the wealthy get wealthier and the poor get poorer. The connected get more connected and the disconnected get more disconnected. So for him, the introduction of the internet was just another way in which he was going to feel outcast from the main line of men. But when his identity is stolen, he has to engage. He's forced to engage. And through engagement, he sort of arrives at an awareness that he didn't have before. I think that's the internet in general. I mean, I think it forces you to get online and engage with it, in part because everything has been displaced online from the real world.
And Joshua, just finally, you mentioned that Paul O'Rourke, the character, the central character in To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, is a character that is out there, that exists. For the Paul O'Rourkes in New York City or wherever they are reading this book in the world, is your novel ultimately a tale of solace, would you say, or is it something where it doesn't really offer answers, that the questions linger?
I kind of have a basic feeling that people don't change in some fundamental way. There is incremental change over the course of time, but the kind of books and movies that suggest that suddenly we can sort of put down our baggage and move on freely through the gentle breeze always strikes me as deceptive and ultimately false. So I was very particular about making Paul's trajectory as a character through the particular circumstances in which he finds himself. I was careful to make sure that didn't ring false. And yet at the same time, I think there is some incremental change that he undergoes, such that his life at the end of the book is a little less bleak and has a bit of a less terrible stranglehold on him than it does at the beginning. So hopefully there is a sense that there is a sense of solace at the end. There is a way out of some of his darker and more consuming despair. I hope that's the case. I think it's also true that it's possible to kind of look on a brighter side if you go through something like he's going through. I think that's legitimate, and I think that's where he ends up.
Joshua Ferris, author of the book and nominated To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, talking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis. It's time now for a bit of music on Midori House on Monocle 24. Regular listeners will be aware that we like to try to link these musical interludes to either the preceding or succeeding item. This one kind of links to the previous item in that it mentions one of the many American authors deprived of an opportunity to win the Booker Prize because they were American. Even better than that, the more I thought about it, the more brilliant this choice seemed. It's by an artist from Scotland who we were discussing earlier, obviously, in terms of the referendum. And you could just about stretch the conclude that the title is kind of what certain portions of the rest of the United Kingdom will be about this time next week if Scotland votes yes. This is Lloyd Cole on the Commotions.
Looking like a born again, living like a heretic, listening to Arthur Lee records, making all your friends feel so guilty about their cynicism. And the rest of their generation, not even the government, are gonna stop you now. But are you ready to be heartbroken? Are you ready to be heartbroken? Pumped up full of vitamins on account of all the seriousness. You say you're so happy now, you can hardly stand or lean over on the bookcase. If you really want to get straight, read Norman Mailer or get a new tailor. Are you ready to be heartbroken? Are you ready to be heartbroken? Are you ready to bleed? What would it take, what would it take to wipe that smile off of your face? Are you ready to be, are you ready to bleed?
Are You Ready to Be Heartbroken by Lloyd Cole and the Commotions from their 1984 debut album, Rattlesnakes. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now to review the best, occasionally the worst, in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books, more, etc. Today we are talking Spanish television, God help us, with our man in Madrid, Liam Aldous. Liam, what have you been watching?
Well, you snigger correctly, Andrew. The state of television in Spain at the moment is in the doldrums. But I've tried to select a few of the best and one of the worst, just for your
pleasure. Okay, well, let's start with the good news. What have you been enjoying?
Well, it's not a particular favorite of mine, but Spain is watching Isabel, which is a period drama based on the former monarch about 500 years ago. It's actually just launched its third season. It's a lot of fanfare, actually. It's promising to be a lot more dramatic and a lot darker than the last two seasons, thank God, because they were quite light on history. But it's actually quite a winner in the ratings, which is a good thing for the public broadcaster, because it suffered a massive budget cut. 200 million euros was cut from its budget. So this series actually nearly didn't get off the ground. It was actually meant to be launched 3 years ago, just when it had the budget cut, and it was put on hold, and then luckily it was a ratings winner, so it's actually turned into the big success story of the public broadcaster.
Okay, we can hear a bit of Isabel, I believe.
Lograron lo que otros creyeron imposible.
Vos y otros sosteníais que era un loco.
Un poder forjado con espadas.
¡Sin piedad!
Sellado con alianzas.
Vuestra futura esposa.
Alimentado con nuevos desafíos.
¡Habrá guerra!
Defenderlo no será fácil.
¡A las puertas!
¡Ayuda!
Porque sus enemigos van a ser cada vez más crueles.
¡Dad la orden!
¡Dadle su cabeza!
Pero nunca tanto como su destino.
Es Dios para mí.
Liam, for those of us whose Spanish isn't quite what it might be, that sounds like an especially deranged coffee commercial. What was going on there?
Yeah, lots of screaming and swords, and there was even a clip of the Queen, the former Queen, spitting in someone's face. So, like I said, lots of drama. It's been hyped up, obviously, for the audience, which are a lot of middle-aged people. A lot of younger people also watch it as well, people that like period dramas. But, like I said, it's been a winner. A lot of people are watching it. I'm not that hooked, I have to say.
Okay, well, moving not at all seamlessly along to television satire, you wanted to talk about El Intermedio, about which I believe you first have to declare an interest.
Yes, I have to, in interest of full disclosure, I was once a presenter on this show, but it was the short-lived weekend version. It didn't last that long.
Do you mean you were nearly the Iberian Jon Stewart?
Well, I was one of many presenters. I wouldn't like to take all the fame, and I definitely didn't take the fortune. But that was last year. The Intermedio, the weekly edition, is still a huge ratings winner. And like I said, it's kind of like Jon Stewart's Daily Show in America, but a lot longer and a lot more ridiculous sometimes. I mean, last night's show was quite interesting because there's been big news in Spain or in Madrid, mainly that our beloved mayor, our gaffe-prone mayor, actually announced that she won't be running for re-election. So naturally, El Intermedio had a field day with this and went to town on the mayor. I was actually surprised that they didn't dedicate the entire show to her, though, because she's more or less a comic's dream. She every time she speaks, she kind of minces her words, and obviously this has been a gift to the producers of this show.
Okay, well, we have a clip of El Intermedio making fun of Ana Botella.
Ana Botella se irá con la cabeza bien alta. Nadie podrá decir que perdió unas elecciones, aunque tampoco podrán decir que las ganó. Para ella, llega la hora de disfrutar de un descanso bien merecido. En unos meses, por fin podrá disfrutar de su afición favorita.
There is nothing quite like a relaxing cup of café con leche in Plaza Mayor.
And finally, Liam, I know you are especially keen to talk about, I'm probably pronouncing this incorrectly, Salvame Deluxe.
Yeah, Salvame Deluxe. I mean, there's two sides to this story. I wanted to bring this story to our listeners' attention because it's a very bad show. I'd have to say it's the worst show on Spanish television, in my opinion. It's actually 4 hours every day, and then on the weekend, on Saturday night, they have another 4 hours. Basically, it's a tabloid format from the Telecinco network, which, as you may know, it's majority owned by Silvio Berlusconi. So you can imagine the kind of format that we're dealing with here. But basically, it invites...
Sorry to cut you off there, Liam. I think if we're quick, we can get a clip of it, and I wouldn't want to deprive our listeners of that.
Ay, Cristina, que eres una sinvergüenza, una mentirosa, una falsa, una timadora, embustera, engañadora, falsa, patrañera, tramposa, tapadora y vende humo. ¿Qué es esto, Jessie?
Me cago en todo un muerto, sobre gracia.
Liam, that sounds perfectly dreadful. What were all those people getting excited about? We appear to have disconnected from Liam Algis in Madrid. That's a shame. He probably didn't want to listen to any more of that clip than he already had to. But that was Liam Algis, our man in Madrid, with his updates on what is big on Spanish television. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that is all for today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier special guests, John Everard and Jim Hoare. Today's show was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rebecca Unger, and our studio manager was Bill Luthi. Next up, after the headlines, is The Entrepreneurs at 2200 The Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.